Craig Settledge, and our topic tonight is Ministry of the Baptized, the whole people of God. And welcome. Thank you for being here. I put on the board a definition, which is a broad one, but one that I think is very important. Some of you were here last night and some of you were not, but ministry in its broadest definition is the service to which the whole people of God is called, whether as individuals or a local community or as the church. And that will, of course, be a very important definition as we talk this evening about Ministry of the Baptized. And I really, I think I'm the only ordained person in this group, so I'm really going to be listening to you tell your stories about how you understand your ministry. Now, I'm not going to have a test or say how well are you accomplishing that, but I really want to explore with you that concept. At dinner tonight, we were talking, and one of the persons at the table said, as this topic was being announced, said, kind of wrinkled her nose and said, "Doesn't everybody know that?" And I said, "Well, I don't think so. That's the challenge, that I still hear people in the church talk about the ministry, and when they say that, they're almost always talking about pastors, about ordained ministry, the ministry. And so people still have this notion that you have to wear a clerical collar or in some way be employed by the church to really be doing ministry. And it took the ELCA 5 years of study and a lot of dollars, a lot of energy, to affirm what really should have been one of our bedrock principles as Lutherans, is that the whole people of God, as this definition says, is called to ministry. And you recall, those of you who were here last night, we talked last night about how God calls us. God calls us, first of all, in our baptism, to be sons and daughters, to be joined to the death and resurrection of Christ. God also calls us then to, once we are joined to the body of Christ, become part of the church. God then calls us to that ministry, which we will talk about. And how we flesh out that ministry, how we understand that ministry, is very important. Let me share with you another definition. And this is one that comes from the ELCA study of ministry. God calls all people through the gospel into community. In baptism, persons are joined to Christ, to other baptized persons, and to the church, which is the people of God and the body of Christ. Through that same baptism, each person is called to minister in the name of Christ. All Christians are commissioned by baptism to announce the message of reconciliation with God. And one of the things that the study of ministry report, or conclusion, finally said, is that if we're serious as a church about what I just said here, then the whole church, that is the institution of the church, needs to affirm the ministry of the baptized, that is to say, to recognize it, to say, here are people who are doing ministry in these places, to support it, and that means to provide adequate preparation. The reality is, and we have to acknowledge this, that in many congregations, people who want to grow in the Christian faith, who want to grow in their understanding of what it all means, are not given the kind of preparation and equipping that would be very helpful. Welcome. These are choir members, right?
Yes.
Great. Out of breath. And the study of ministry said that if we're serious about this, then we should do a better job of equipping people for their ministry. And one of the important things that's happening right now is that in the churchwide assembly that's going to be held next month, the final report of the theological education study is being given. And one of those, one of the very important pieces in that study, in that report, is to say we can use our seminaries in a better way than we have in the past to provide theological education for people who are not church employees. And I'm going to try to avoid the word laity. I don't know, because you heard a little tease about that today from Walt, because there's a history about laity. But let's, for the time being, let's just talk about theological education for the whole church, not just for people who are preparing for church occupations. The other thing is to say that if all Christians are called to a ministry, it's important to understand that that ministry is carried out not simply in the church. Again, one of the mistakes I think that many pastors make, and I myself, I acknowledge that in my earlier ministry, I think I was more guilty of this than I like to admit, is to see the energy of a congregation needing to be directed primarily toward that congregation, that is, the stuff that goes on in a congregation, and that's important stuff. I mean, you need to have people who are going to make sure a congregation gets its stuff done. But if you do that and in the process neglect talking about where people are spending 98% of their time, that is, in the world, if you don't make that connection, then we as pastors, and now I'm not the only pastor in the room, so I feel a little more comfortable. We as pastors are not doing what we should be doing, and we understand a part of our ministry, a very important part, is to equip the baptized for their ministry. So how to make that connection, and that's probably what I want to talk about, and I hope that you're willing in a little bit to talk about how you understand in your congregation. You don't have to name which congregation it is if you don't want to, but is that connection being made? Are people in your congregation being helped to make the connection between their Christian faith, the gospel, their call to ministry, and what they do in the world? And the setting, and this again is a part of Luther's understanding, is that the setting for ministry is for most of us in a variety of settings and relationships. We are called to ministry in terms of our family, the people for whom we have close relationships, our work, and how we spend that bulk of time that we're supposed to have called leisure. I sometimes wonder about leisure. It often escapes me, but that's probably my problem, not the time. But more and more people do have time that's not committed to their occupation. And so how they spend their time beyond the work setting is another place. Let me now refer to, and I'm not going to keep talking, I'm going to stop in a second, but in What Shall I Say, and last night I mentioned that if you haven't read this, you need to pick up a copy in the bookstore. Walter Bowman is one of the two authors of it. The other person is Sue Setzer. And this book was published a year ago, less than a year ago, it was published last September, primarily to assist persons who are in the process of discernment about whether God is calling them to public ministry, to rostered ministry as a pastor or an associate ministry. But there's some wonderful sections in here on ministry of the baptized, and I'm just going to read you a section of this. Vocation, and those of you here last night will remember some of this, I hope. Vocation is God's call at baptism to belong to God's family and to be a worker in the kingdom of God. The very word vocation is based on the word vocatio, which means to be called. Occupations are only one avenue for Christian vocation. Discerning God's call involves clarity on one's abilities and gifts, as well as attention to the needs of the world. And then there's this wonderful quote from Frederick Buechner, who's one of my favorite writers, and probably some of yours as well. This is a wonderful quote, and I'll read the whole thing to you. By and large, a good rule for finding out is this: the kind of work God usually calls you to is the kind of work, A, that you need most to do, and B, that the world most needs to have done. I'll do that, say that again. The kind of work God usually calls you to is the kind of work, A, that you need most to do, and that B, that the world most needs to have done. If you really get a kick out of your work, you've presumably met requirement A. But if your work is writing TV deodorant commercials, the chances are you've missed requirement B. On the other hand, if your work is being a doctor in a leper colony, you have probably met requirement B. But if most of the time you're bored and depressed by it, the chances are you have not only bypassed A, but probably aren't helping your patients much either. And that could easily be applied to a lot of pastors, I'm afraid, who are doing what the world needs, but they're not energized by it. And then he goes on, neither the hair shirt nor the soft berth will do. The place God calls you to is the place where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. And since I know some of your occupations already, I would suggest that some of you are very clear that, in fact, what you need to do in your work and what the world needs have, in fact, been met. But as we said last night, that's not true for all people. So it's very important that we understand that our vocation as Christians is not limited to our occupation, because it may be that our occupation is not something that energizes us or that gives us the opportunity to respond to what the world really needs. I'd like to pause here and just get your reaction to that. Does that make sense or? Comments? Anybody?
I think any time that you encounter someone that makes a difference in your life, they have met both of those. In the fact that they're energized by what they do and they bring an energy to it that then enthuses you to the point where you want to go out and do more yourself.
Because it's that person is responding to your need.
Right.
So the world's needs can be focused down into one single individual's needs.
But they can do the most mundane thing that's part of the job and make it seem interesting. Because they bring all these things to it to make it very interesting.
Can you think of an example
in your own life? Well, the greatest influence on my life was this choral director, Olaf Christensen, brought to his conducting style a life that was just enthusiastic, and then of his whole philosophy of life that came every day. And so you were in these rehearsals, and an hour and a half would go by just like that, and you couldn't understand why it went by that fast, and yet you had learned greatly from it. And yet people would sit in that same situation, two people, and one person will go out and will have learned greatly and be able to do or carry on something, and another person will have sat in that same situation and maybe some of the things have gone beyond them or they didn't absorb anything. And yeah. I don't understand that, but it was there for me.
Yeah. Anyone else?
Well, I think this, the one-to-one type thing, when we are serving someone else, and it's a joy to us and a joy to them, it is because we are reflecting God's love to them. Just as it is such a delight to do something for someone you know and love. So I think the same process works when the love is not from within us, but God's love, which we feel and are able to pass on to someone else. I think that's a major part of this process of serving.
Yes, and I mean, finally, we know, how does God love us? Well, God loves us through people.
Through people, exactly. That's where it is.
I mean, our love doesn't come floating down from the clouds.
A person who feels that love of God and is doing something that they really enjoy, you know, vocation-wise, that they're good at, and they do that, then I think people note that. I mean, they are affected by that. They see somebody that's just bright and shiny and just does their thing, and it's just wonderful, you know, and everybody says, whoa, you know, and then they get into it too, and I think that's partly, you know, a person's individual response to the word, you know, the gospel, and how the gospel's affecting them in everything. I mean, you know, it could be doing, I don't know, you could be doing garbage detail or dishwashing, or, but, it, you know, if you're really into it and you make something out of it, you do influence other people, or you do see it in other people. It is a reflection of God's love to you individually and to those other people.
In my, we lived in Wilmer, Minnesota for 10 years, and there was a man who sang in my church choir. His name was Al Loniger. And Al was a man of God just to the end. And he made his living by installing insulation around doors. But he was called upon, well, anyone who knew that they wanted to have good insulation called on Al. But that went to larger places. I mean, corporations would call him and ask him to do things or whatever needed to be done with the buildings because they wanted things done correctly, and Al was that kind of person. But I was at his bedside when he died of cancer, and you know, I came to offer him help or to ease moving from one life to the next. And I went away with this just a sermon. And he was that way his whole life.
He was probably ministering to you as he said goodbye. I've had that experience before.
Yeah, that's
at the deathbed of someone. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. The powerful possibilities. I think we it is easy to recognize, as Don was saying earlier. Not easy. I mean, it's important to recognize that the expression to another individual of God's love. I mean, how does a person know God's love? It's through persons touching a person, speaking that word of love, and there is no more wonderful experience in life than the experience of being loved by another, whether that's in the relationship of marriage, in that most intimate expression of love, or if it's in the very intimate expressions of very close friendships, of an individual, of knowing that an individual cares for you and will care for you and is one with you. And we have those relationships, hopefully, in a number of places in our life. Another challenging setting is in within our families. Most families that I knew as a parish pastor, and the families I still know, all have their own conflictual things. I mean, there's always things going on, and how to minister to one another in that setting is not always so easy when there is conflict or there is anger or hurt or whatever it might be. Another setting then of the work setting. For some, it's easier to minister in one's occupation. Those of us who have it easiest are those of us who are expected to do that in our employment, in a sense. That's what people expect. It's more difficult, it seems to me, in the office, in the laboratory, in the classroom, wherever it might be, in the hospital. How do we, in those settings, minister? Is ministry in the workplace limited to our acts of love or not? How do any of you who have been in workplaces, whatever the setting is, how do you understand, are there opportunities for ministry, or do you see ministry in those places? I'm really asking the question very seriously because it's I'm not in those places in the same way that you are.
I think there is, but for me, and this may be more of an expression of my own personality, It is more difficult there. It is more subtle. I think you often witness by who you are and the way you live your life, the way you react to things going on in that workplace. These can sometimes give you the entree into being more outspoken or more overt in your ministry. But I think it's often very difficult to do. If you push too hard in that kind of environment, it usually backfires. It usually, instead of being an effective ministry, it's a negative one. So, and as I say, that may be partially just a reflection of my own personality and my own interaction with people, but it is certainly my experience.
I was thinking, parallel to that, I kept thinking, as you mentioned the word ministry, the parallel word witness. Mm-hmm. And I think in your last example, it's easier to witness. You know, in other words, be a good Christian, witness your own life rather than go out of your way to try to minister to people who may resist. Because this is pretty much what you just said.
Yes.
That in some workplaces, how do you minister? To me, minister is to go out and assist or
it's the caring for the individual, the service.
And in some places, people don't need or don't want service. But for you to witness, it's kind of a, hey, this is the expression of how I feel about my relationship to God. And you do it subtly, do it carefully. But that's a parallel. How do you see ministry and witnesses, you know, related to each other? Is that...
I think that's one of the things that we'll be talking about throughout this week and into next. But last night, let me respond to that by giving an illustration. Last night, some of you, who was here for the forum? I know, Paul, you were. Anyone else? And Rachel? There was a forum last night on what we would like the church to be and do...
And look forward to the future.
Yeah. Yeah, it was kind of like the church, and we let it was very, very open ended. But what was interesting is that we ended up after a lot of discussion and a lot of conversation. People had a whole list of, remember this, filled up this board of laundry list of things, and then we said, well, now a lot of those sound like any social organization, a Rotary or whatever. I mean, it sounded like stuff that people do when they get together. Then we said, well, what's different? What's unique about church? And we began to distill it down. Well, we ended up by saying the traditional marks of the church, one, holy, Catholic, and apostolic. And then someone said, well, what the church does on Sunday is gather word, share the word, bread and wine, and then is sent into the world. So the sending is the apostolic witness. That's a long answer. I'm sorry. I'm coming around to it. Yeah. So, but one of the essential marks of the church always has been that the people of God both gather together around word and sacrament and then are sent back into the world in the apostolic witness.
Let me interject something here. It was pretty easy for me, being a teacher, you know, in my school. In previous years, too, you know, just kind of... You know, I mean, they knew the previous pastor, and I, you know.
Well, the first grade kids didn't know. Your teachers did.
Well, my teacher friends did. And, I mean, kids, I mean, they don't know much. You know, they think he's my father. You know, you know, who's your father? I need to pick you up. So, I mean, that's the only thing they know.
Let's not rub it in, Rachel. Let's.
I'll go on. Recently, we have a lot more children. Like Arabic children and Muslim children, and I have received letters from parents who have reminded me at Christmas time that they don't do Jesus, you know? They don't do, you know, that their children don't do Jesus. That's not the thing. And so, kind of put the kibosh on everything, you know? I mean, like, you don't, you kind of tippy toe around and you don't talk a lot about, you know, Christian things because they're not Christian. And you know, you're cautioned not to do that in a public school. So it's kind of, I mean, I still, obviously I still do that to a point, but...
Interesting to see how the schools interpret President Clinton's latest communication about that. And I've not read carefully enough to, but it's...
what was it he said?
Religion can't be excluded from public
right.
schools.
I read that. Yeah.
It'll need to be inclusive. You'll probably need to talk about the Islamic faith.
Then we get into that whole thing about how you talk about God.
I agree with what you said. I'm a fourth grade teacher, so.
Are you?
Yeah. And right now, too, there's, you know, that big separation between church and state.
I know.
And anything you say, you feel like it could come back in a different way than what you meant. And I found that the best thing that I can do to show my students my beliefs is just to love them all.
Right.
You know, and just to treat them with the same respect.
Absolutely.
And
yeah,
that's about all you can do.
That's
I
right.
feel.
That's
because
good.
Of the bind that we're in.
Yeah, I think, you know, you do have basic respect for human
sure.
beings and, you know, you treat the children that way. But it does, it just kind of puts a little different spin on things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you are not so vocal about, we used to read the Nativity, you know, the Christmas story in class. I mean, it was just another way of, you know, teaching about Christmas, the celebration of Christmas, because that's what Christmas is. We don't do that anymore. And my teaching partner, and she put around, she's hanging up all these, she's Roman Catholic, she's hanging up all these little creches and, you know, and all this stuff. You think you ought to do that? And she said, yeah.
Yeah.
So she was, you know, more ready to do that than I was, and I said, okay, so we did. So
I think I can kind of turn around something I said before, the relationship between the ministry and witnessing, because I spent 30 years as a high school counselor, and I retired 6 years ago, and I don't know how you people anymore do what you do in the classroom. It's got to be so frustrating. But 35 years ago when I first started, it was, you could do almost anything in your classroom. But my last 8 or 10 years were very, very difficult because I was in a very, very wealthy community. And the people expected that our job as counselors was to help their kids from rich families get into prestigious colleges.
Yeah.
So witnessing was totally out of question. You just don't witness to the Lord in your office, you know, when you're counseling with kids. But ministry is something else. You could minister to their needs in very, very subtle ways.
Yeah.
I guess I answered my own question.
Isn't that wonderful?
Because it was one of the, and I got very, very frustrated. I found it very easy to work with certain types of kids, and I knew I had to get out because I couldn't. When kids came in and said, I want to be a doctor, I want to go to medical school, and I would ask why, 9 out of 10 would say, I want to make money. And the 1 out of 10 would say, because I want to help people. Well, you know who got more more ministry from me. I mean, it was just one of those natural things. Kids in school, it's a difficult situation. I don't know how you do it.
Well, I mean, I haven't changed the way I react, you know, interact with the children. I have somewhat parents, a little bit of reacting with the children, too.
But let me use it as an illustration that in the case of the two of you as classroom teachers, the witness in terms of the opinions you express, the values you espouse, how you respond to issues that come along among your fellow teachers, your colleagues in teaching, is an arena. You see, that's an arena that may be very different from the arena that you have in terms of your classroom with the children. And that's true for many occupations. I'd like to shift a little bit to the discussion about how well you're being equipped. I mentioned that earlier. And it's important because Thursday evening, we'll be talking about pastors, about ordained ministry. And that I'm anticipating that may actually spill into the next day too, because there's going to be a lot to talk about. But one of the questions, as I mentioned earlier, is about the equipping. The reason I omitted the word laity in the little announcement that I gave Walter to make is important to say that what Luther reacted against was a situation in which vocation meant religious occupation. Those who had vocations in the church were those who were priests and members of religious orders. And so Luther was dramatically sharp in his ability to turn that word around and say, no, vocation is the calling of all Christians. A dramatic change. Similarly, the very use of the word laity, which in fact we Lutherans are quite comfortable in using even to this day, is a word that really is inappropriately used. Laity is often defined as what you're not. If you're a lay person, you're not a pastor. Yeah. Yeah. You're not ordained. You're not called. Whatever. Whereas the word laity, and my colleagues will know this, laity, the Greek word laos, means people. It's the people. And in the New Testament, there was no separating out of the people of God from anybody else. They were the people. Already in the New Testament, as we talked last night, there was differentiation in terms of tasks and roles, but not in the New Testament a hierarchy of you have the laity who are not clergy. So in the Second Vatican Council in the Roman Church, there it was a real attempt to get past that use of the word laity as being what you're not. So I really frankly try to avoid using the word. It's easy to say lay and clergy. It's just kind of a neat little kind of rolls off the tongue. You've all heard it 100 times, I'm sure. But to talk about the baptized people of God, who include those of us who are called and ordained to church occupations, but that the whole people of God are the people of God. We are all the laos, the people of God. But the task of those who are pastors among them is to equip the rest of the baptized, the 99% of the church, for their ministry in the world. And the perception that we have from my position is that it's not happening enough. And let me just give you an illustration. One of the results of the study of ministry was to say that there are times when the need for ministry in a place can't be served by rostered persons. And if there are ministry needs like that, the ELCA now has a provision that bishops may authorize or license, and we're going to try to use the word authorize rather than license, authorize a lay person.
There we go.
To do that ministry under the authority of the bishop. And that is a good example, for example, is in rural settings, western North Dakota, where they have a continual inability to provide pastors to remote rural congregations. So in that synod, the bishop will authorize a person who is not ordained to provide that ministry of word and sacrament. I think it happens in Montana. It happens in a lot of places across the church. Well, this is just his background. A part of the ELCA policy now is that synods have programs of preparation to equip those persons for doing that particular ministry. Well, where synods have developed programs to do just that, they have found a lot of people signing up who have no particular intention of serving in that kind of ministry, but because they say,
I want to go to some place that helps me understand what it means to be a Christian. I'm not getting it in my congregation. And that's an indictment. I mean, it really is. But they hunger for more content, more theology, because they want to be able to understand how better to live out their Christian ministry in the world. So if what we're seeing, and this, there's only a less than a dozen synods who have these programs, but already we're there, I'm hearing from them what I just said to you. That suggests to me that there may be a lot of people out there who are saying we want and need more.
So the authorization isn't the important part of it.
Right.
It's the person who needs to improve or understand his Christian life.
Exactly. It's not the authorization that's important. It's wanting to be better equipped to do what we're talking about this evening. To be in the world.
Well, I'd recommend they open the whole.
Good. Good.
Sure.
That's a resource.
This is why we come every year after year. Same reason.
Say more.
And it totally changed our lives. We started to come to hold it back in the early 80s. Oh, no, 79, I guess, was the first time. And I frankly don't get it that many of the congregations I've ever belonged to or pastors, you know, and you said before, they're distracted by personal things and problems and things like that, the management of the congregation. You don't really get the theology, the understanding of Scripture, the depth that we're getting right here in this room right now, and that type of thing, out in our home congregations. And I need, and my wife needs, every year, we need the recharge. And frankly, we're flaming liberals too. So we're not getting fed that out in our congregations out in the world either. So we do come to Holden Village for that purpose. And it has remarkably changed our lives in the last 20 years. We're different people from what we were 20 years ago.
This may be a difficult question. I'm not sure I can phrase it. What have you found to be the most significant help to you in terms of looking back in your experience of Holden? What has been the most significant help to you?
Confidence in being able to talk about our life in Christ. The knowledge that there are people here and the ministry here that's so special that it just reinforces us and gives us the strength to go out there for the other 49 weeks out of the year and witness. Also, the way we have lived our lives, and I really like the description that you've written up there, because we are full-time volunteers at this point, and we honestly feel the call to run a food bank, to do hospice work, of course, we're retired. We can do that.
Well, they're retired people who use their time differently, so that's...
I know, and I feel very sorry for retired people that I see saying, aren't you bored? What are you doing? But we don't have enough hours in the day. You know, we have a hospice patient, and you're running a food bank at the same time, driving for Meals on Wheels, and my wife is on the board of Head Start. We love every minute of it. But this is why we feel a call, and we feel this strongly from what we get from Holden Village. And then every year we come back for 3 weeks. And we have to have it. It's a vital part of our lives. And we just feel so sorry for people who are not getting that.
I'm impressed the way what you're really talking about is witnessing, service and witness. You just covered them both in your illustration. And the difficulty that most Lutherans have in being able to speak the name Jesus is just, to me, incredible. We Lutherans, I think, are probably, talk about being the bottom of the food chain, we're at the bottom of the witness chain in terms of people being confident enough, as you just said it, to speak to others of the gospel. How many congregations exist in the Lutheran Church
where people think the pastor is the one who is supposed to be doing the witnessing. We pay the pastor, you know. She or he should be doing that for us on our behalf. Go out there, pastor, and witness.
It's his job.
And I wonder, Craig, if we're perpetuating that. I wrote a little essay to this effect that's on sale at the bookstore. What is contemporary worship? You may buy it for $5 overpriced. But I reflect there on what I call the one flock, one shepherd principle. And it seems to me we are perpetuating exactly that kind of misunderstanding of the church when congregations schedule multiple services on a Sunday. We're giving the impression to quote-unquote lay people that their job is to come to the gas station to get filled by the clergy. And the hotshot clergy these days are designing designer liturgies, especially for populations of, you know, special populations of people. And I think that's perpetuating a wrong picture of what the church is, and certainly a wrong picture of what worship ought to be. But I haven't heard anybody else make that speech except me.
Well,
so maybe I'm a crackpot. I mean, that could be.
You're right.
But I think it's something to think about. It's an ecclesiological issue that needs addressing. Do multiple services perpetuate the notion that the church down on the corner is the religion franchise, like McDonald's or Wendy's or Burger King, and lay people come in droves to the service of their choice, their designer liturgy, mm-hmm. that suits their needs and their temperament and their type of music or whatever. And it's the clergy who are dispensing this, who must think up ever more ingenious promotions to keep the customers coming in the door. That's part of my problem with entertainment evangelism.
Misses the point completely on the part of the pastor to correct the entertainment factor. There's something that's so more important, so much more important than that.
Yeah.
Our daughter lives south of St. Paul, Minneapolis area, and when we go back there, we have visited a variety of churches, and I can remember one church we walked into. Where they were handing out badges as you walk in, visitor, and it said visitor, and we pinned it right on us. And we walked in, we participated in the worship service, and as we were walking out, not one person talked with us.
Oh,
nobody. Now, I don't care how entertaining or how hard that pastor worked, he missed the boat, or somebody in that church missed the boat. The important thing is to make the people feel comfortable and happy and welcome in that congregation.
Like the story of the woman after the service who turns to the other woman sitting next to her and says, "Are you a visitor in this parish?" And the other woman says, "Oh yes, I've been a visitor in this parish for 10 years.
Well, and as we were saying earlier, and thank you for sharing that if the oneness is not clear, I mean, I think what you're arguing, I think a part of it, what I'm hearing, is that the oneness is not evident. If it's just coming in individuals, checking in, and then having no sense of even the oneness of that congregation,
right.
much less the oneness of the whole church.
Yeah, it's very individual. It's consumer-oriented. Mm-hmm. You're coming in there to get your fill, and you go out, and the other people aren't important.
And probably the filling is just for one's own needs.
Right.
That's the other part of it. I mean, how often have we either heard or ourselves said, "Well, I didn't get much out of worship today or the sermon today." And often that means my needs weren't met. Now, it could mean it was a crummy sermon and the liturgy was done sloppily and all that.
But then I ask, what did they give to the service?
Right.
You know, I mean, that's
But this part of it, you see, I think we Lutherans do a pretty good job most of the time. Well, less than half of us do by the statistics, but at least we understand as Lutheran Christians that we gather together around bread and wine and the Word. That's so much a part of what it means to Lutheran, it's self-evident. But what it means then to be sent, and the sending is not sending the pastor then out to make calls. That's not what is being talked about. It's the sending of the church, of the baptized, into the world.
into work and family and relationship settings to be the people of God.
But then how are they to be equipped?
Right.
Yeah.
That's the question.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I just want to add another perspective, because you're talking about going to a church service and being filled, and I guess I kind of see it that way, in that you go to a service to be, like, rejuvenated. Like, you come here to be rejuvenated so that then you can go out and do your work. I mean, you know, help out that way.
Yeah.
So that you become spirit-filled so that you can give that spirit to other people.
We wouldn't argue against that.
Oh, okay.
Because
that's why I was kind of getting confused, because I'm like, you know, that's kind of how I think about it. So,
yeah, Paul, why don't you respond? I think that
there's a sense in which every worshiper, including the pastor, praise the Lord, ought to go out of worship rejuvenated and inspired and filled. You know, how many pastors look forward to Sunday with dread?
Oh, I used to love it on Sunday morning.
I did too. I had a wonderful time on Sunday. And I came out, as I think a lot of worshipers did, filled and joyful and spirit
was contagious,
motivated and all that great stuff.
There's nothing wrong with
if you think that it's your pastor's job to give that to you, there may be a mistake then. In other words, you have to contribute something to it as well. And the pastor is the cheerleader for the team on the field. I used that figure in my class this afternoon. The team on the field are the people in the pews. They are the important ones. And the pastor and the musicians and the worship leaders, they are simply the cheerleaders.
I think that most congregations I've ever worshipped in, belonged to, or visited, might say behind the scenes that they're comfortable with the cheerleader and the team analogy. Except, if the ushering is all done by pillars of the congregation, usually male, if the lessons are all read by adults, if the choir is all the same people every time, and the praying is done by only one voice, pretty soon you start to think that my role as a team player is to be here and to sit here and to try to keep my kid quiet so that grandma in the next row doesn't frown. And even if you didn't walk in with a mentality of this is a concert, you know, I'm here to sit and the action's up there. Even if you didn't walk in with that mindset, what you see happening in front of and behind and on either side of you sort of gives you the mindset. You came in ready to pray, and you came in ready to visit before and after, and maybe even during the service a little bit. And you came in to smile at people you know and to smile at people you don't know and to praise God and to pray together, but your role is pretty minimal. Your chance to participate is pretty short.
Our architecture contributes to it too. In most churches, you're looking at the back of somebody else's head. Terrible.
I had a congregation. It was a wonderful building we built because we always saw our faces of people. Because the sitting was on three sides, and I think part of the response is what happens in worship, how the people and Paul and I could both probably talk a long time about that. How the people are involved in more significant ways, and more people are involved in significant ways.
My congregation doesn't do a bad job. We do a pretty good job of involving.
The whole breakthrough.
Most congregations.
And that may be. I think the whole breakthrough of understanding the role of people who are not ordained, of the baptized in the assisting minister parts of liturgy was a major help.
Absolutely.
to changing some of that. And the congregations that use a variety of people, young and old and male and female, and a richness of assisting
many
ministers.
Many Lutheran parishes, maybe even most Lutheran parishes, are ignoring that altogether, and they're still leading worship the way the Red Book provided, one man, male.
Yeah, and that's distressing.
I hope that people who are in congregations where participation on Sunday morning is more diverse. I hope people like myself, I hope we remember to appreciate that and not take it for granted. And I hope that the next step is that on Sunday morning there is better recognition of the ministry that we do 7 days a week.
Yes, now thank you for that, because that in the few minutes we have left, let me just say this. I think, and to answer your question about how do the pastors equip the baptized, I think that there are several things that can be done, very specific. I believe that in the sermon, most pastors can do a better job of connecting the word with the ministry and witness of the baptized in the world. I'm afraid that that isn't always done very well. And I now in a position where most Sunday mornings I'm sitting in the pew rather than in the pulpit. I do preach as often as I'm permitted and as I can, but I'm more often listening. So I've learned a lot. And I just had a conversation with my pastor in the last couple of weeks and said, I think that the connections are not as clear or self-evident as you might think they are. That's the first point. Second point is, it's fairly obvious, but we have failed. We've done a very poor job in terms of adult education. Every indicator would suggest that we Lutherans are very low in getting people just like yourself to sit in settings like this and explore. Now, part of that, I know pastors who beat their heads against the wall trying to get people to just come. So what you can do to encourage your fellow members and congregations to do that is very important. Thirdly, if I were a parish pastor, I would at least once a week have lunch or in some way visit a member in their work setting. I would work it out, and in most places you can. There are some places that you can't do that. But in most settings, even if it's just over lunch, you can visit a person in their place of employment and talk to them about, well, how's it like here? And what are the issues here? What are the problems? What does it mean to be a nurse in this setting? You're in a hospital, is that right? Yeah. To sit and talk about that. Some of the most significant conversations that I had with members of my congregation were in their workplaces to talk about that. So I think that begins then, you see, if the pastor has a knowledge of where it is that you work and what are the issues that you're facing, it will help her or him to better make that connection between the word that they're proclaiming and that they are called to proclaim and your ability to interpret and communicate that word in the place of your work. Well, let me just thank you. Let me close with this. Well, there's so much. Luther just understood that the whole world is the setting for God's work. And Luther understood that God calls and sends people into the world in all of the roles and responsibilities of everyday life. And it was that understanding that we have to recapture in the church today. And I would commend to you this book and anything, I'm missing the title now. The author is William Deal. Bill Deal.
Everyday Christians?
Yes, thank you. Everyday Christians, I believe, is one. He's got more than one. But he is a layperson who has been very helpful in making the connection between the ministry that we are all called to as the baptized and the setting in our secular world.
Is he the author of Monday's Ministry?
Yes. Diehl. Well, I think our time is over. The blues group just let out. Thank you all. And if you're interested, you're welcome. Thursday evening, same time, same place, we'll be talking about ordained ministry. Thanks.